Good morning, everybody. If I could have your attention, please. We are ready to get started. Thank you very much for being here this morning. It's a very exciting day for us here. This is a Yeshiva University presentation, a day of learning, positive Jewish parenting, which is hosted by United Orthodox Synagogues and the Goldberg Montessori School. Just going to very, very briefly run through the schedule with you so that you know what to do. Everyone should have a packet of materials, all the materials that you'll need, regardless of which sessions you're going to attend, are in this. I'll bring some extras in and distribute them. Immediately following the first session, everyone's invited to attend one of the workshops. There are three choices. Dr. Applebaum, how to talk so kids will listen, and how to listen so they will talk. That will take place in the library. Rabbi Yaakov Neuberger, having realistic religious ambitions for our children. That will take place in the chapel. And Rabbi Ari Siegel will talk in the main sanctuary right here on Jacob and Esav, how to recognize and nurture the differences in our children. Those sessions will end around 11:40, after which everyone could go into Tabernas Hall, which is the room right behind us, to pick up their lunch, and then go to their second session. We're running the same three workshops again, so you have the opportunity to attend two out of the three sessions. The second one is a lunch session. Bring your lunch, and you could hopefully eat and listen at the same time. And then at 12:45, everyone is invited back here for the closing talk by Rabbi Neuberger, Raising Happy and Inspired Children. If you have children here, don't worry. We will bring lunch to them. Yeah.
I was wondering,
everything's being taped. You could listen. Yeah. Okay. Our speaker this morning is Dr. David Peltovitz. He is the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Professor of Jewish Education at Yeshiva University's Azraeli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration. Prior to joining Yeshiva University, Dr. Peltovitz was Clinical Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at New York University School of Medicine and Director of Psychology at North Shore University Hospital, NYU School of Medicine. Last night I was talking to Levi Mostovsky, who's here from Yeshiva University, and said it's very nice that Dr. Peltovitz has this fancy bio, but he's just the man. He's just the guy that the Jewish community in New York and all over the country turns to with issues dealing with stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, impact of divorce on children, adolescent behavioral problems, child abuse, all those things. So Dr. Peltovitz, you are officially the man. And we're very grateful that you took time away to be with us. I'll quickly introduce all the other speakers that are going to be talking today, as I will not have the opportunity to do that when they start their talks. Rabbi Yaakov Neuberger is Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University Major School of Talmudic Studies, an undergraduate school for Talmudic Studies at Yeshiva University. He is also the spiritual leader of Congregation Beit Avraham in Bergenfield, New Jersey. From 1986 to 1990, Rabbi Neuberger was the spiritual leader of the Jewish community at Yeshiva University's Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And most importantly for me, he is my personal Rebbe and teacher, who I turn to regularly with questions, both of a halachic nature and general policy. I'm very grateful to you, Rabbi Neuberger, for coming in, flying in late last night. It's very, very special to have you here. Thank you very much. Rabbi Ari Siegel is the Judaic head of school at Barron Academy, Robert M. Barron Academy, Houston's largest yeshiva day school. Rabbi Siegel spent 6 years as director of student programming at Ramaz High School and youth director at Congregation Kilat Jeshurun in Manhattan. Prior to moving to Houston, he holds an MSW from the Wirtschaft School of Social Work. And Marilyn Applebaum is a proud member of United Orthodox Synagogue. She is director of the Applebaum Training Institute, an organization dedicated to training teachers, and is a well-known authority on families, change, and education. Marilyn is especially known for her books, Do It Right, A Positive Guide for Discipline, and How to Talk to Kids So They Listen, which is also the topic of her talk this morning. I once again welcome you all, and thank you for joining us. And now it is my pleasure and privilege to introduce to you Dr. David Peltovitz.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Gelman. And thank you. It's been a wonderful weekend here. It's such a warm, enveloping community. It's been a privilege. Two things before I forget. One is, on the handouts, I was noticing that because of the vagaries of PowerPoint, some of the references There's a Jewish saying that you have to always cite properly, right? You have to say things in terms of the source. So just the source of my handouts, some of this stuff is my own, but a lot of it comes from a Dr. Delmonico, who's an expert in this area, and from a respected site called safeteens.com. That got lost in the, when you do PowerPoint in outline format, the citations die. So don't see this as all my own stuff by any means. And also, one more thing before we get into the heart of this is that I have to apologize ahead of time. My favorite part of talking is staying afterwards and talking to people and discussing. But I have to practice what I preach in terms of what I was talking about all Shabbos. And that's that I have a family, four family members are being honored at a dinner in New York City that I have to be at. So I have to catch a plane immediately after this. So I'm going to be rushing into a kip. So I apologize for my rudeness ahead of time. I'm going to rush out of here at 10:40. Now for the talk. Actually, I think an incredibly important topic. And let me start by the frog and the beaker analogy. And it goes like this. Take a frog, throw it in a beaker of boiling water. It will jump out and save its life. Take the same frog, throw it in a beaker of water, that's normal temperature, but over a low simmering fire. The temperature will go up very, very gradually, and the frog won't realize that it's in mortal danger, and it'll boil to death. And that's the imagery that I wanted to start with, because we're too close to it to see it. I'll start with a personal vignette, okay? Even though I don't like telling stories, as you know, but I'll start. I'll make an exception. A personal vignette goes like this. My youngest daughter, who's 15, 16 years old, asked us if she could rent a movie. And it was an R-rated movie, which we would not normally allow her to watch. But my wife and I look at each other, and we realize we had seen that movie back maybe 25 years ago. And we were trying for the life of us to remember, why does it have an R rating? Because we remembered it fondly as a clean, wholesome movie. So we made a deal with her. We said, you know what, we'll watch the movie with you. And if it hits the point that we think it's inappropriate, we'll stop it. So we go and we put it on our VCR. We start watching the movie. And the movie's going and going and going. And throughout the movie, my wife and I are trading glances at each other. And for the life of us, I have no clue why it was rated R. I have no clue why it was rated R. And I started to think that I'm the frog in the beaker. I changed over the last 2.5 decades from the time that movie first came out. It's not just that the movie rating system changed, so that the R of today is totally different than the R of a generation ago. It's that I changed. I changed in that my compass for what it is that's appropriate and inappropriate has been totally shifted without me even realizing it. I don't realize that the temperature of the water has shifted around me. And that's basically, I wanted to share with you a number of points and a number of recommendations on this topic. Let me start first with, I'll start with something that I almost always forget to talk about. And I briefly in my hotel room this morning re-reviewed the literature in the psychology database, because I hadn't done that for a couple of years. I just wanted to see if there's anything new. And that's on video games. I'll start with video games, then go to television, and then go to what's probably the most important, which is the internet. Video games. What do we know about video games? Those of us who have, I imagine most of this audience has predominantly children of video game playing age. No? Not really? How many of you have kids who play video games? Okay, so looks like about 90% of the audience, and some don't. But okay, I'll just talk briefly about it, and then I'll get to the internet. Video games, it turns out that what is it about video games that we have to look at? By the way, there are some positives. There's clear research that shows that it really does help your visual motor ability compared to television, which is a passive experience. It's a more active kind of a force. But it's the subtle messages that you have to be concerned about. Very often, as you know, the majority of games have very vivid, aggressive imagery, And the question is, okay, so what? Does that really matter? The reality is there's some new neuroimaging studies that came out in the last year that show that after a kid plays a video game for a while, there's their amygdala, for a couple of hours later, the seat of emotional arousal stays lit up, and the frontal prefrontal area, for men who put on their shelroche, the area around the shelroche shuts down. The thinking part, the part that makes us human, shuts down. In a way that makes it so that it's not surprising to us that kids who were heavy users of aggressive, especially first-person shooter games, which are among the most popular, it actually impacts on them in a way that a number of research studies now show that those kids have more aggressive imagery, are less likely to be kind and empathic to others, sort of an indirect finding. But again, it's the frog in the beaker. It's what does it do to your soul to play that? I was talking a little bit earlier to Dr. Applebaum about this, and she reminded me of a story that I was planning on sharing with you. But it makes me feel good that we were both thinking along the same lines in terms of what Dr. Applebaum saying making the same comment. Fascinating study. A lieutenant colonel, I think, has done this research, and it goes like this. In World War II, there was a significant problem where about one out of four men were unable to kill the first time they were in combat. Now, that's a major training issue, right? So if you are effectively losing a quarter of your fighting force, that's a problem. So they had to have special training units in the United States Army during World War II to teach men how to kill in a real-life situation. Doesn't come so easily, thank God, okay? In the Vietnam War, there was no need for that. Unfortunately, in the Vietnam War, men were able to kill without special training. Why is that? Because it was the first war fought by the television generation. It's the frog in the beaker. What does it do to our souls to watch television over and over again, violent shows, to play violent video games? How does it desensitize us? Obviously enough so that in the laboratory of real life, there's no need for special training on how to kill anymore. And in fact, of course your kids aren't going to become violent and severely aggressive only because they're playing video games or only because they're watching TV shows that are aggressive. It's more of the subtle changes. And that's something to think about. A South African psychologist gave a talk a generation ago, just before they introduced television to South Africa. And he predicted that in the generation after television is introduced to South Africa, there'd be a doubling of the murder rate there, corrected for political violence. And he promised to come back a generation later and present his results. Because it was based on studies of other cultures and other populations, what happened to them after TV was introduced there. And in fact, he did write that article. God was good to him. He survived that 20 years. A little chutzpah dig for him to have said it. But 20 years later, he wrote an article saying that he slightly underestimated his predictions. There was more of a doubling of the murder rate in South Africa the generation after television was introduced there, even when you correct it for other kinds of violence. Now, what's the bottom line? The bottom line is that this stuff really does matter, and there's a crucial role for parents in moderating these kinds of external influences. So before I get to the internet, I just wanted to make a couple of other quick comments and then some recommendations. Comment number one is that the number one antidote to dealing with overwhelming or inappropriate material on television or in video, if you're going to allow your children to watch. I'm going on the assumption some people deal with this by just saying no TV or no video games or whatever. But let's say you're not going to go in that direction and you're going to try to be the moderator or the mediator of that experience. The number one antidote is to talk to your kids about it. The research shows, for example, parents who sit with their kids and talk to them about the impact of the video game and limit the time, put limits on. I was talking over Shabbos about the key to parenting the Talmud tells us is the balance between the left hand pushing away while the right hand brings closer. The balance between love and limits. And to the extent that you do that with your children about television and about video, that seems to be a very helpful way of dealing with the negative influences. So if you sit with children, and as you're sitting with children, you are even playing the games with them or watching the TV show with them once in a while, and then you talk it out, it turns out that makes a difference. It may not totally undo the negative impact, but it does make a difference. Everything's about naming the monster and talking about it and using it as a teachable moment to impart values. I have a friend, a colleague I've done some writing with. His name is Bessel van der Kolk. Very well-known psychiatrist and expert in trauma. He's been at Harvard Medical School now. He's at Boston University Medical School. And he's a little bit of a nut when it comes to trauma. He's passionate about understanding it. And a friend of his was in the World Trade Center 5 years ago during the attacks, caught in the stairwell. A man who's a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist runs down the stairs, barely escapes with his life, and develops post-traumatic stress disorder as a result. And Dr. van der Kolk, trying to understand this a little bit better, asked the psychiatrist if he could submit to an fMRI, meaning he took a picture of his brain as he was having a flashback to that horrible day. He was doing this as part of the treatment, but also as a part of trying to understand trauma better. And what he showed me in the picture of this fMRI was that as this man was reliving the most horrible moment of his life, as he was flashing back to the World Trade Center crumbling around him, Broca's areas shut down, meaning the language centers of the brain shut down, meaning that he was literally rendered speechless. And that's what upsetting events do to us. They render us speechless. They literally shut us down. And then what Dr. van der Kolk was able to show that as he was helping this man recover, and as he was giving him words for the tragedy, and lighting up Broca's area, that's where healing came. Now to take that to the more mundane area of day-to-day exposure to frightening images or inappropriate images or whatever, the job of parents is to light up Broca's area. And that's pretty much what the research is telling us. Talk to your kids about upsetting events. If you're going to allow them to watch TV shows, sit with them once in a while and use it as a way of imparting important values. The Kaiser Family Foundation every 2 years takes the pulse of the content of every television show that's on national television, and they find it's unbelievable what they find. They find that every 2 years, there's a tremendous increase in not only the amount of sexual content on sitcoms on television, but more recently, in the last few years, a tremendous increase in the portrayal and depiction of sexual scenarios without a corresponding moral messages. So it shows adolescents and young adults engaging in sexual behavior without any sense of moral responsibility to the other, without any sense of a relationship. So you may say, okay, what does that really do to our children? In a recent survey done by the American Medical Association, reported in JAMA, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, it was a fascinating statistic. I think for the first time in history, this is happening. More than half of young adults in the United States say that they wish they had waited longer before engaging in sexual activity. Okay? And perhaps even more importantly, the more kids watch sitcoms, the younger they are when they engage in sexual activity. So this stuff matters. It matters. And again, the role that you all have in terms of lighting up Broca's area, naming the monster, really is the antidote if you're not going to go to the other extreme of taking television away altogether, which is, by the way, a more viable way to go than one might think. But that maybe we could talk about in the discussion. One last word on television, and that's the TV news. It's just an important thing to think about. Sometimes you think, well, that's at least educational. Let our kids watch television. Psychologists at the University of Pennsylvania have talked about something called the mean world syndrome. The mean world syndrome is a syndrome where when you look at kids who are heavy TV news watchers, they start to view the world as being a far more dangerous place than it really is. They think that, you know, the flood in New Orleans or the bombs in Israel or whatever trauma is going on in the world is just as likely to happen in their own backyard. And they develop a certain fearfulness. And it's something to keep in mind. The research shows that if you have a child who's in the 15% of the population that's anxious, a kind of worrying, nervous child, they're particularly prone to become upset by exposure to television news. If there's a big story happening, it's important to shield them from those visual images, okay? If they have to get the news, then let them get it from the print media, from listening to the radio. Our rabbis tell us, Eino domeh shmia l'ra'iyah. There's nothing quite like watching something. And visual images can really have an impact on a child. So it's important to keep in mind that especially if something upsetting is happening in Israel, or there are particularly gruesome pictures coming out because of some big tragedy in the country or beyond or locally, so local news for sure your kids shouldn't be watching, and you need to be careful about it. So to summarize what I said until now before we go into the internet, the core points are, okay? The core points are what your kids see and do and experience on television and in video games does have an impact. Is it going to make them into stark, raving lunatics who are out of control? Of course not. But it has subtle impact on their souls. It has subtle impact on their view of the world. It has subtle impact on the way they treat their fellow man. And your job as parents is to be there in terms of getting them to think about it, talk about it, and to impart the values to them that reflect your dreams for them and their future and your vision for the way you want them to be in terms of continuing their education. Okay. Yes. The research shows actually that for certain vulnerable kids, they actually can be directly impacted by seeing visual images, either in video games, which again are repetitive and put you in there, or with certain TV shows. And if you have a kid who's vulnerable in that way, you probably need to take a much more active role in sheltering them from that. Let me move on to the internet. I know there are a million questions. Let me just quickly do the internet with apologies, and I'm hoping maybe there'll be time for discussion later in the workshops, which are, and I apologize, I feel badly about my time constraints, but let me move on with this. Okay. If you could look at the top slide, A Hidden Danger for Children, there's some very important statistics there. The one that's perhaps most upsetting is the second bullet of the top slide. The average age of internet exposure to pornography is age 11. Not that kids are out there trolling and looking for pornographic material. That's not what it's about. It's not what it's about at all. It's about that kids are doing homework, and they accidentally, let's say they'll get an email. They'll open up the email, and the email's a pornographic email. It's coming in as spam. Or that they're searching for something as part of a research project in school, and again, they'll open up something that they may have been diverted to. We were just talking on Shabbos about how whitehouse.com, totally reasonable place to punch into a search engine, will take you to a pornographic site. And that's what the research shows. The research shows that the average age for children is age 11 when they accidentally will stumble upon pornography. 70% of kids say that that's the way they come upon it the first time, and 1 out of 5 report being sexually solicited online. Now, how does this play itself in our own world? I've had the experience of speaking to a number of day school students around the country, especially middle school students, about this topic, and I'm amazed at two facts, and these are the main points I want to make to you. The two facts are the following. Fact number one is most of them say, oh yeah, we know exactly what you're talking about. So there's no reason to think that our kids are any more sheltered than other kids. But perhaps the more upsetting fact is when I asked them the question, how many of you know more about the internet than your parents? Every one of them raises their hand. Every one of them. We all know that, and that's good. They could be our gurus about the internet. But when I asked them, how many of you have been up against upsetting material on the internet? More than half raised their hand. And these are 6th, 7th, and 8th grade kids, little kids. Then when I asked them, how many of you feel comfortable going to your parents about what you find, then I get a very different answer. Less than half usually say they're comfortable going to their parents. And that's the main point I want to make about the internet. The research on the internet shows the following. It shows if I did a poll of everybody here in this room and said, how many of you have clear rules about the internet in your home? Most of you, if you're like other communities, will raise your hand and say, oh yeah, we have clear rules. But then if I asked your children, how many of you feel that your parents have described to you clear rules about the internet? Only a fraction will say that. So there's a disconnect. There's a real disconnect. Very often parents think that they're guiding, they think that they're leading, they think that they're dealing with it, and in fact, the kids don't feel the same way. So a couple of the points that are written down here are important to keep in mind is number one, the bottom bullet on the top slide, 1 out of 4 kids report that they're significantly distressed by some of the material they come across on the internet. When I speak to kids, they tell me this. They openly tell me this when I speak to them at lectures. The average adolescent will not tell their parents what they do online, as I said a few minutes ago. And it becomes super important to set a understanding with your children about basic safety rules. If I could bring your attention to the second page in the back. There's something called a parent-child contract for internet safety. I don't propose that you necessarily go home and hire a lawyer and get a notary and sign this contract with your kid, especially if you have pre-adolescent kids. But I would suggest that certainly if you have a kid who's 10 or older, that you use this maybe as a springboard, okay? I met with a group of day school kids recently in a middle school setting. I showed them this contract, and we talked about it. They talked about how real it was, how real it wasn't, whatever it was. It's an important thing. It became a springboard in that community for talking about internet safety. It became a teachable moment. And if you look at it, it has a very clear set of rules and guidelines that you want your kids to know. What happens on the internet is a very anonymous medium. You don't realize that in the safety of your own room, everything you say has the same impact as something you would say in public. And kids need to be taught that. There's a real problem out there with cyberbullying. There's a real problem out there with kids giving out information they never give in a public anonymous setting. But you do it on the internet because there's the illusion that you're in the protective cocoon and protective safety of your home. And kids need to know that. They need to understand that because they often don't. I have some guidelines here on that component and on that issue. Law enforcement people will tell you how pedophiles will troll the internet to try to find kids just like they would in the real world, but it's so much easier on the internet. A major recommendation is if it's not too late, if you could have the computers in your house in a public area, not in your child's bedroom, that makes a difference. Another major recommendation would be that to the extent that you might want to think about using filtering software, there's some software that an article sponsored by the American Academy of Pediatrics is on page 2. That's just an example of some of the software that's out there. But perhaps most importantly, this is the single most important recommendation. Monitoring alone is not going to do the trick. You can't lock up your kid and throw away the key. The key recommendation is you need to monitor and supervise in the context of a good relationship. The best way to protect your kids is to know what's going on, to talk to them about some of these issues brought up on these handouts, but also for them to know that there is nothing that they could come to you with that will lead to the loss of your love. The most upsetting thing I heard from kids in that talk that I gave last week was how many of them said, tell my parents about the boy who threatened to rape me online. They'd kill me. Well, I say, why would they kill you? Oh, they just kill me for even talking to a boy online. And here was this girl who was silently suffering with that fear because she knew that boy. She knew who he was, and he was a disturbed kid, and she wasn't going to any adult for help with it. Now, was she any real danger? I don't know. But to me, what was so upsetting was how many of the kids have built up in spite of having loving parents, in spite of having parents who were the right-hand specialists, okay, of being hugged and being loved and having parents who really cared about them, because our kids sort of see the internet as their sphere of specialty, they don't necessarily see their parents as the gurus. So it behooves us to reach out to them. There's some very easy ways to do it. I wanted to learn a little bit more about MySpace and about Facebook. MySpace is something that in my youngest kid's school, the school outlawed it because there were four or five stories in the New York area of kids who were on MySpace and had been victims of pedophiles because of it. So in our region, I don't know if that's happened out here in Houston, in our region we don't allow MySpace. Kids are actually, pretty much that message has gotten through. But most high school kids are on Facebook. Facebook is a site where it could be, you know, it could be under the school, let's say. It's a very, very commonly used site by high school kids. And it's a site where they could communicate with each other, and there's a lot of wonderful stuff that could come from it. But there are problems that could come from it as well. Kids sharing pictures that are inappropriate with each other. Kids disclosing things that later come back to haunt them. Or kids saying things about the identity of other kids that could easily make them the prey of unsavory people out there. What I would suggest is the best antidote is communication. The best antidote is take your kid and say, teach me about some of this stuff. Now, some of you have younger kids. That's even better. It's just sort of like to start to get ahead of the curve on this in terms of understanding what's out there could be incredibly helpful. And kids love being tutors to their adults, to their parents. So to give them the chance to teach you things is an incredibly important tool in terms of trying to get your hand around this. Bottom line is that what this whole weekend was about, and what today in particular is about in terms of this conference, is about, in essence, putting our hands around our kids, being able to get more educated about how to communicate with them, how to recognize their uniqueness, and how to become aware of things that we wouldn't necessarily know just by dint of being parents. And let me end with a story, and then maybe we could have a little bit in the way of questions. A nice story, because it's about the whole right-hand specialty part. I had an uncle, my wife's uncle, who was a GI in World War II, and he was with a group of American soldiers 60 years ago who were about to go in and liberate a concentration camp. And their commanding officer gets up and tells the men, you're about to go in and liberate a concentration camp. There are a number of children who survived this camp. You've been going around Europe and giving out chocolate bars to children, Hershey bars to the kids that you see. Whatever you do, don't give chocolate, don't give any food to these kids whatsoever. Their digestive systems are so undeveloped that it could prove fatal to them. So my uncle goes into the camp and he heads straight for the children's barracks and sees the horrific scene we've all seen pictures of walking skeletons. He doesn't know what to do. So he goes over to one of the kids and gives him a hug. And spontaneously, one behind the other, a line of these children forms, patiently waiting for a hug. And that's the message I want to leave you with. We all metaphorically and figuratively are pretty good at hugging our children. Interestingly, the research showed, because these kids were studied into adulthood, that as long as that hug continued metaphorically into their adulthood, resilience was the norm. They did fine, thank God. We know how they turned out. But it's all about the hug. It's all about lighting up Rocha's area. It's all about monitoring in the context of a good relationship. In terms of dealing with external influences are a force for incredible good. They're a force for unbelievable educational opportunities. They're a force for connection. They're a force for a hug. But they also could be, like the frog in the beaker, a force for dirtying our children's souls. And what today's all about is us collectively lighting up Rocha's area, reaching out to our kids and giving them a hug. So thank you, everybody. And, So the rabbi is allowing me two questions. No, I'm only kidding. I'm allowing myself two questions. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm English. My family from England. The name is me, TV. I have silence on the TV all the time. I mean, in England, they have a 9 o'clock rule. And even after 9 o'clock, the violence would be limited. You'll never see a full film you'd see in a cinema on TV. They'd always limit the violence. And I don't understand why nobody's doing anything.
Yes, it's just such an important point to repeat it for the tape and for the audience is in the UK there's much less violence on television and certainly no blatant violence that kids could be exposed to after 9 o'clock. I remember coming across a news story once that said that most children's television programming originating in the United States is censored by European censors before it'll be allowed overseas. So we have a tolerance here, in particular for violence. And why that is has to do with, I think, certain cultural norms that the United States stands for. It's probably an interesting sociology and political science set of concepts. But it's very upsetting. And again, that's why we have to, as parents in a country that's unusually tolerant of violence, especially given the literature I told you about, how it really matters. It really, really matters. It's all the more important for us to take that kind of active role. Thank you. That's always helpful to hear cultural stuff. Let me hear from you and then I'll rush to get my cab. Yes.
I'm sorry, Ellen. If it's not a question for Dr. Palkovitz, let's save it for later because his time is limited and people want to hear from him.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. But if you don't mind saying it after I leave, I appreciate it.
Do.
Yes. Yes, so the question is it enough to do that? And that's a very personal kind of decision. For example, you could say, no, we're not going to allow these violent video games at home, because obviously it's better not to expose them at all, but if they're obsessed with them, they're going to go to a friend's house and play it there anyway, which is what usually happens with the internet, then what's the point? You know, it's no matter what, we have to share with them our thoughts about it. All things being equal, if you're going to allow it, limit the time, limit the content. I would not allow a first-person shooter game in my home. I really wouldn't. That's just too scary to me. Okay, I don't know if you've ever seen them. They're scary. You're there. How can it not impact on you? So I would say limit the content, limit the time and talk. If you could get rid of it altogether, great. But if you can't because of your friends, your kids' friends having everything, then do these other things. But the default setting would be if you could get away with not having it at all, that's the best. That's the best. I'm not sure who to take from, but you know what? I'm so indecisive. Okay, go ahead. Yes. And this will be the last question because I'm going to catch that plane. Does what? Oh, sports video games, from what I read, no. Sports video games is a great example. That's a great example. Go out and get sports games, you know. I understand that the kids let the faculty win the game last night. I heard from the kids they made it look very close. But you see, great midos could come through sports. The children have been so kind here. No, I hear it was a real game. But thank you, everybody, and I feel badly about having to leave. Thank you.